afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. I'm Melody Cedarstrom, and you are listening to Financial Survival. James Corbett of the Corbett Report will be joining Dave Allen for the second and third segment of the program today. So please stay tuned. We'll update you with the market report. So let's just get started right away. Today is Friday, March 16th, 2018. We're going to go ahead and go right to the gold prices before we do a little bit of the paper markets today. A little bit of pressure on gold today, down $3.10 in the New York spot, $1,313. Silver was down 6 cents, $16.41. Platinum was down $4 at $953. And palladium was up 8 at 1,001. You have the USDX today that is continues to get a little bit stronger, 0.08 at 90.20, and crude oil was up 110 at 62.29. Paper markets today, all positive. The Dow, a little over a quarter of a percent, up 72 points at 24,946. The NASDAQ, basically unchanged, up a quarter point, 7,481. And the S&P was up 4 points at 2,751. So they did struggle on the day to stay in the green territory. I did see earlier the Dow was up triple digits, reversed it a little bit. But the 10-year yield popped a little bit today. 2.85%, and the euro was down with the dollar stronger, 0.32 at 1.23. I did want to take and it's really interesting to see this emotion as far as it's like, Melody, are you going in there again? Are you going to do that again? Well, I find it kind of interesting because the world, our economy, confidence, 17-year highs, but yet this fear and greed index is still showing some extreme fear. So when you see that low of a number, you kind of wonder what's pushing that high confidence level. I think the jobs is a big thing, and we'll talk about that here in a little bit. I wanted to see Bitcoin today. That was down. Where it was up today, 84.92, I saw reports where they're expecting it to go to 2,300. And that's a big drop from 8,400, close to 8,500. But they're expecting to see that. And these are people who are Bitcoin fanatics that are basically saying that you'll be seeing those lower numbers. So we'll keep an eye on that. It's just interesting to follow. Do I believe in all the cryptocurrencies and all the hoopla? No, I just think it's another spin. It's another bubble. And it was just another way to get a lot of people's money. And just like Rob West when he was on the program, that's who I should have had on today for this first 20 minutes. I should have had Rob West on today. He's the one that said he put a couple thousand into a cryptocurrency, and it now shows he has, what, 43,000 in there? And I told him to buy gold. He says, I can't. He says, I can't get my money out. I was like, then what's the point? What's the point of investing in something and it's not liquid? Well, it'll be liquid in October. Oh, okay. Well, I wonder what you're going to have then come October, you know, since we know how volatile so many things are going into after the summer, August, September, and October. You know, those are the most volatile months of the year. So we'll see if he gets it out. We'll have to have him update us on his little cryptocurrency to see where it's holding at. And we'll try to get him on next week to have Rob West update us on many parts of the economy that that he follows. So I do find cryptocurrencies interesting, but again, I think it's just a bubble waiting to burst, just like everything else. It's like we live in a world of bubbles. And, you know, I guess to some degree, we could think that as, you know, kind of pleasant. You know, when you're a little kid, you blow bubbles, you know, and you see all these different size bubbles and so forth. But the one thing about when you blow through that little hoop, the soap, and all those bubbles go up, they all break. And while those bubbles are floating around, yeah, you do, you know, you see all the rainbow colors floating through them, and, you know, they turn, you know, pinks and greens and blues, you know, depending on how the sun is hitting those little bubbles. And, you know, when one pops, though, they all begin to pop. And then you just go back into your little container of soap and blow some more bubbles, and you have the same, you know, the same results. So it's kind of the same thing. So I guess we have all these bubbles in all of these areas of our finances in the world economies, and we're just waiting for one of them to break. And then we know they will all follow suit shortly thereafter. There isn't, once in a while you'll get one that reaches the ground and will just stay a little bit on that grass before that pops. But anyway, so that's what I look to cryptocurrencies as. There was, what's interesting in these paper markets, it's barely been a month since we had, what, a 10% little bit of a pullback in the paper markets. But investors have jumped back into stocks in record numbers. And again, that's another sign that we're close to the bubbles breaking. Stock-focused funds took in $43.3 billion in fresh cash over the past week. That's a new peak that reverses much of the angst over the past several weeks. This report was out by the Bank of America. So interest in equities came as stock market indexes staged just modest gains. The S&P 500 was up about 1.4% for the week. The Dow Industrials have been flat during this period, and this is the week ending March 14th, so, you know, 2 days ago. Investors had pulled $9.4 billion from stock funds the previous week, and bond funds also are looking up with $2.4 billion of inflows, and that was the same Bank of America Merrill Lynch report. So, again, people are getting duped. Get into that paper market. You know, it's reaching all-time highs. That's when you want to get in. You know, you're supposed to get in when markets are low, ride it up, enjoy the ride, and then sell when you're at the top. Very few people will ever hold on and sell at the peak of the top. It just doesn't happen. Rarely. Can't say it won't. Some people do. It's just luck. And then you have that market break. People think that, oh, wow, you know, it's just a little bit of a pullback, just like what we saw. People pile in thinking that it's going to go higher. And then we'll have another little pullback. And the next thing you know, you're just holding on. The next thing you know, you've lost 50% of your money. That's how quick it will happen. And you just get caught up of the ever-increasing, thinking that there's nothing that ever pulls back. And, hey, we saw it in gold. We saw when gold was reaching, I mean, I knew it was being pushed up by paper markets. I didn't know how far they would push it. I saw the physical demand was beginning to slack off. Didn't know how far the paper pushers would be able to get the how high the price of gold could go. So we reached 1900, and there was, I don't think anyone ever called it. Because the conditions of our economy weren't the best yet. And but gold is different. Gold is a lot different than just those paper markets. Gold can never go to zero. Gold will never go to zero. Where, take a look at the Toys R Us. You know, what are they going to do with all those storefronts, all those warehouses that Toys R Us had? People are getting canned. No severance pay. No pensions, if they even had a pension. So things do go to zero. Even those companies who, you know, like, gee, how can a toy company go bankrupt? You know, when little kids get anything they want, eight times what they need, and a toy company. But I was also reading one of the reasons that they felt that they had gone deep into debt in the 90s, and that was one of the reasons that broke their back. They were just too deep in debt, and they couldn't reinvest any of the money that they had because of the debt. Does this sound familiar? And they couldn't upgrade their storefronts. So, you know, it wasn't a pleasant shopping experience. You know, you go into something that looked like a warehouse, you know, just thousands of toys with no direction. And so, you know, people, you know, kind of lost it. They didn't want to go there anymore. I saw the one in New York when we were in New York about I don't know, 6-7 years ago. And I'm looking in this store and I'm thinking, who would want to go in there? It was packed. You couldn't move. It wasn't inviting. And it's a lot like a lot of our other stores, our other retail stores. And I've been saying all along, Macy's. And, you know, all these retail stores, they're so much in debt, they can't reinvest into their company. So they can't make it better for the person who walks into the store. And I think most people want to touch, feel, and go in, but why would you abuse yourself going into some place that isn't pleasant to be? Anyway, so that's about it for the markets today. There was another report out today that I thought was sort of interesting. The U.S. job openings rebounded to the highest on record in January, reflecting a solid job market. This is the Labor Department showed today. Number of positions waiting to be filled increased by 645,000. Private hiring rose to 5.24 million, and 3.27 million Americans quit their jobs, down from 3.34 in December. Quits rate eased to 2.2% from 2.3%. Basically, that's suggesting that workers are confident that they will be able to find another job. You know, so they quit, hoping they can go out and, you know, maybe get a little bit better pay and so forth, which is interesting because when I was in the job market, you didn't quit your job until you had another one, you know. You didn't pre-quit your job. And that was when things were good. That was when you could go out and you could go anywhere. You know, I was in the insurance business and the banking business for years, and I never had any problem going from one company to another to improve my education, to improve my my experience in those industries. Today, it's not so much the same. But so there was a lot of the rise in openings was mainly due to increases in construction, transportation, and warehousing, and professional and business services. Job openings rose in all four U.S. regions. Let's see if there's anything else. The economy created a net 2.1 million jobs. And although it lags the Labor Department's other jobs data by a month, the JOLTS report added context to monthly payroll figures by measuring dynamics such as resignations, help wanted ads, and pace of hiring. There was something else, and I saw this in the same report. Even though you had the biggest gains in job posting since mid-2016, wages are still cooling. Wages cooled last month. And everyone is expecting that to pick up, but it isn't. And I had mentioned several times that I had wanted to talk about why we're not seeing the same type of wage increase in this supposedly hot market of jobs, and everyone seems to be puzzled by it. And they keep, you know, if it moves just a fraction of a point, you know, everyone gets all excited about it and thinks things are great, that wages are finally rising and, you know, we're going to see inflation, the good inflation, not the bad inflation. Like, there is a good and a bad, which I don't think there is, but, you know, let the experts explain it that way, the good inflation, the bad inflation. But on the first Friday of every month, you have the Labor Department. They do release the latest numbers of employment and wages. And I only have about 4 more minutes left of this report, so, you know, I'll try to carry it on, or maybe I'll even post it in our newsletter. And you can sign up for our newsletter by going to the website dgscoins.com, dgscoins.com, and the little mailbox there, just, it's very user-friendly. You can also listen to these programs. They're archived and daily and long-term. And you can call Discount Gold and Silver at 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. And I do have a bag of VG Plus. It's a half bag VG Plus Peace Dollars. And they're selling for $19. So they're considered 90% silver. These are the silver dollars, peace dollars, VG plus circulated, $19 a piece. It's a few cents less than what a silver eagle would cost, but you can't, it's not really not apples to apples because the silver eagle is a full 1 ounce. But a great buy for some circulated peace dollars. They have to be sold in a half bag or full bag. Half bag is 500 coins. 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. And this report of the Labor Department again tells about employment and wages. And in a market economy, as unemployment falls and unoccupied workers grow scarce, workers should be able to bid up their wages. Under conditions of full employment, generally considered to be about 4.5%, wages should rise. And that's what all these economists expect, but they don't. Today's wage increases, which have averaged a little above 2% a year throughout the current prolonged recovery, barely keep track with increases in the cost of living and are roughly half of wage increases in previous recoveries. The new census data show that household incomes are rising now, having finally surpassed the recession peak in 2007, which itself only matched the pre-recession peak. There is a gap between rising incomes and stagnating wages. Household income can increase when workers get more hours of work. That seems to be exactly what's happening. According to the census data, Americans already working full-time whose hours didn't increase didn't see any growth in income that would have required higher wages. So therein lies a key distinction. Now, you're adding to a worker's hours is commonly the prerogative of management. Winning a pay raise, on the other hand, usually involves and often requires some initiative from the workers themselves, golly gee, which in turn requires some bargaining power. No worker initiative, no bargaining power, no raise. The factors that diminish worker power, even as low employment augments it, have been amply documented. The very thought that the Federal Reserve may still consider a low employment rate to be decisive evidence of looming inflation should instill some doubt that the Fed understands the actual 21st century economy. And therein lies the problem. Our economy today is not the same as it was. And there are some factors that low unemployment notwithstanding undercut the workers' bargaining power. You have globalization. You have the rise of non-standard employment. You have the rise of non-compete agreements. You have the rise of robots. You have de-unionization. All of these plays a factor into these lower wages and why the wages are not increasing. And at another time, maybe we'll break down each one of these and see how the impact of the globalization, the rise of non-standard employment, and so forth, impact the wages. 1-800-375-4188. Dave Allen and James Corbett will be joining you here in just a few short minutes. Thank you for joining us, and thank you for listening to Financial Survival. Please stay tuned.
Since the beginning of the United States, kings have sought it, nations have fought for it. It has been traded, borrowed, purchased, and stolen. There is a reason for it: to secure the blessings of liberty to ourselves and our posterity. Invest with the security of gold and silver. Call Discount Gold and Silver Trading at 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. Listen to Financial Survival with your host, Melody Cederstrom, on Shortwave Radio. Visit DiscountGoldAndSilverTrading.net or call 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. For the very best in gold and silver trading, call toll-free 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. Call now.
Melody Cederstrom and CSE Talk Radio team up as Common Sense Voices of Integrity. I personally endorse Melody Cederstrom to be your trusted go-to expert for all your precious metal needs. Experts agree a financial crisis and even collapse is inevitable. Given our government's lack of economic leadership and self-interests of those in power, it's no longer a question of if you should purchase gold and silver, but if you will purchase gold and silver before it's too late. Melody encourages you to tune in each weekday morning. Visit CSE Talk Radio.com. We both agree truth and education are the two significant factors in both our missions. There is a wealth of misinformation out there. Let Melody and Beth Ann help you sort through the chaos and bring you home to the truths that will ensure that you and your family are protected. Call Discount Gold and Silver Trading 1-800-375-4188 or online at dgscoins.com. Melody and Beth Ann are strong forces together working to preserve liberty and bring America home.
And welcome back to Discount Gold and Silver Trading Company's Financial Survival Show. This is Dave Allen, your host for these last two segments. I'm pleased to welcome back the always informative and thought-provoking James Corbett. As listeners know, James is the founder and editor of the provocative and entertaining, and we'll say thought-provoking, Corbett Report. You can view virtually all there is to know about James and his worldly viewpoints at thecorbettreport.com. James, good to have you back.
Good to be here. Thanks for having me on.
Absolutely. How are you today?
I'm doing all right. Not too bad. Things are bright and sunshiny, and spring is returning to Japan, so things are looking up.
Beautiful, beautiful to hear. We've got a bunch of things to talk about with you today. We're going to start off with something that's been in the news here a lot in the last 2 weeks or so, and I'm sure making its way around the world as well. James, as you know, tariffs here in the States, as well as the countries that are trading partners with the U.S., are front and center on the minds of policymakers and business, certain businesses at least, and citizens at large. After President Donald Trump announced the imposition of a tariff of 25% on imported steel and 10% on imported aluminum, newspaper and internet headlines both here and abroad have featured an abundance of positions, both pro and con. Now, when George W. Bush imposed 30% steel tariffs back in 2002, Japan, I believe, was America's largest trading partner. Today, China is. 16 years ago, China responded to our tariff with its own on Harley-Davidson motorcycles, and before the U.S. tariffs were able to run their course, Bush withdrew them. But resentment ran deep, and memories have yet to fade. So I guess my question to you, James, to start off the show, are tariffs ever a good idea in the global economy, and how are Japan, China, and other major U.S. trading partners in your neck of the woods reacting?
Well, I would say on the former question, I would say no. Tariffs are essentially a tax on the tariffing country's population. Essentially, it's, hey, let's make this a little bit more expensive for you guys to have these products. So from that perspective, it's certainly not a good thing. And I don't imagine this is going to fundamentally transform the American economy. But on the latter part of it, it's interesting to see the way that various countries are reacting to this. And I can say from the Japanese perspective that Japan is already lobbying the U.S. Trade envoy to make a special exception for Japan, as is the EU trade envoy also lobbying for that exemption, because there isn't a lot of clarity at the moment as to, you know, what, where and how and if exemptions will be applied to this. And of course, that's all just code for, well, you know, obviously this is a part of a trade war with China. We don't want to get caught in the crosshairs of this trade war. So, hey, let us through that net.
Indeed. Indeed. Do you think a trade war is on the horizon?
I would say that this is a good sign of heading in that direction. I don't think this by in and of itself is really the onset of a full-on trade war, but it certainly could be the beginning volley shots of it, or at least a warning shot across the bow. And that wouldn't be surprising, I think, given the team that Trump came into office with. People that I've talked about before, like Peter Navarro and others, who are China hawks, who have been arguing for essentially a trade war with China. So I don't think it's surprising that it's heading in that direction, although it is surprising that it's taken over a year before the Trump administration has really gotten around to doing this. So we'll see. We'll see if this is the sign of the way the administration is going to go from here, or whether this is just a one-off to help the trade of the steel industry, perhaps helping secure some Republican votes in some areas where that's needed.
Yeah, indeed. I mean, you may have read that Pennsylvania had a big special election last evening. The suspense, in fact, goes on as we speak. Although the Democratic challenger Connor Lamb has been cast as the apparent winner. In a really close duel that was, you know, just hundreds of votes between the two candidates all of last night and into this morning, until I guess enough of the absentee ballots were counted that the ones remaining in the one or two counties aren't large enough for the Republican to sort of overcome. So that's interesting, and there's, as you can imagine, all sorts of spinning today by both sides. So it certainly sets, I mean, what I find funny, I mean, it speaks to how badly gerrymandered states like Pennsylvania have become. It's entirely possible, and some people, the pundits, are saying almost certain that these two candidates will face off against completely different challengers this November, as they'll be both running in different redrawn congressional districts than the one they battled out for yesterday. So, yeah, fun stuff. I read last evening too that the Japanese government is exploring the possibility of a summit between Japan's Prime Minister Shinzo Abe and North Korean leader Kim Jong Un. Apparently, that evaluation comes on the heels of Abe and others being briefed by a South Korean envoy who spoke with Kim in Pyongyang last week. While the Abe administration has long advocated caution in talking with North Korea, it now anticipates a fresh chance to make progress, I guess, towards resolving the issue of North Korea's abduction of Japanese nationals in the 70s and 80s, that according to unnamed sources. James, do you know anything about those abductions and why they're so important to Japan and its people after more than four decades?
Well, I mean, I think it's just a sign of the overall relationship between Japan and North Korea. I mean, imagine if Mexico was abducting American citizens and had held them for decades. I would imagine that would be a pretty sticky thorn in the side of the United States. So it's not hard to imagine, especially whenever the topic of North Korea comes up in Japan. I think this is one of those issues that gets raised. And as I say, I think it's just kind of a bellwether of the relationship in general. So it is difficult to imagine that there would be much progress between Japan and North Korea without that issue being resolved in some manner at some point. But obviously, I think the denuclearization is the bigger part of this, and it's going to be the U.S. North Korea talks that's going to be, I think, the main event.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, we know that Abe plans to visit the U.S. early next month, I believe, and meet Trump to coordinate their North Korea policies ahead of what will be the first ever meeting between a sitting U.S. president and a North Korean leader, perhaps as early as May. They've been talking about, are Japanese citizens hoping for anything specific beyond the denuclearization when the prime minister meets with our president in Washington?
I think that's going to be a main concern. But I think also the question of the potential for some sort of China trade war and how Japan will be caught up in that will be another, I imagine, another point of particular interest to Abe when he goes to Washington.
Yeah. You know, I can't help, but the latest edition of your newsletter features an article that starts like this. Listeners, this I'm quoting from James's article, with James's presumed permission. It has all the elements of a Hollywood heist movie, a well-known jeweler to the stars, and a shady accomplice. A risky gambit to exploit a banking loophole. Inside help from a high-ranking official. A $2 billion swindle, and the whole house of cards crashing down in spectacular front-page fashion. I love your writing. James, once again, you got our attention. Tell us about this sordid story, please.
Well, it does sound like all the pieces of some high-budget Hollywood action flick, doesn't it? And
it does.
The interesting part of this is it all revolves around an Indian jeweler named Nirav Modi, who has come to the attention of people who are in the glitterati in Hollywood over the last few years because what he calls haute diamantaire, which is a way of saying fancy schmancy diamond jewelry. Back in the 2008 economic crisis, Modi bought a bunch of, no relation to Prime Minister Modi, apparently, but anyway, bought a bunch of diamonds on the cheap and started a high fashion diamond jewelry outlet, and wasn't long before he had some connections and was making some sales to people on the red carpet in Hollywood and made a big business out of it. But this is all coming to some weird head at this point, surrounding this incredible story of how apparently, and this is all alleged, nothing's been proven in court, but at any rate, it seems that Modi and his business partner slash uncle, I believe, were involved with the Punjab National Bank, which is an Indian state bank, in a scheme that it's somewhat complicated, but essentially there's these the Indian state banks can issue these letters of understanding, LOUs, to foreign banks that are essentially like a credit guarantee, but basically saying to the foreign bank, you guys can lend to these guys, they're good, and if they don't pay you back, then we're on the hook for it. So it's essentially, it's like a it's almost like it uses the established credit relationship between a customer and a bank to basically say, act as a kind of collateral for a foreign loan. And apparently what was happening was Modi and his partner were getting these LOUs from this Punjab National Bank to go and borrow money to the tune of $2 billion from some foreign banks, basically Indian banks with foreign correspondent banks overseas, and they were not paying that back, and the Punjab National Bank ends up on the hook for that. But the twist to this story is that they had inside help, apparently, from at least a couple of people on the inside of the Punjab National Bank, because these LOUs are issued through the SWIFT network, which is the international banking network, communication network that communicates all of these transactions between banks. And so you would think, well, the SWIFT network will register these LOUs, and so it'll be on the records of the Punjab National Bank. But it turns out the PNB does not have its SWIFT network connected to its actual banking data. So the SWIFT transactions have to be manually entered into the bank's own system. And because they had inside help, those weren't being basically logged into the system. So,
well, that was convenient.
Yeah, exactly. So it turns out, here's a bill for $2 billion, and the bank's saying, what? And that's, I think it was equivalent to one-third or one-quarter of the bank's total market cap. So it's a significant amount of money. It staggers the imagination how this happened and went on for apparently 7 years before it started to unravel. At any rate, so it started this big international manhunt for Modi. I I'm not sure if he's been found, quote-unquote, yet, but at any rate, he was in Switzerland, he was in New York, he was at World Economic Forum in Davos. Where is he today? His lawyer says he's not running from the law, he's just a busy businessman with lots of things to do, and he hasn't been officially charged yet, so it's this big scandal. But the long story short is, they definitely had some inside help here, and it's just interesting the ways that these types of scams can unravel, And my thought about this is that one of the takeaways from this story is going to be, oh, look at these outdated systems this bank was operating. They need to upgrade. They need to make sure that everything is linked into one central database. And, oh, by the way, India is right in the midst of a push by March 31st, all Indian citizens have to have their bank accounts linked to their government biometric ID, which takes their fingerprint and iris scan and puts it on an ID card. They're going to have to be linked. If you want a bank account in India, you're going to have this government-issued ID by March 31st. So I imagine this will be rolled into a, hey, let's modernize the banking industry in general type of narrative.
That's pretty amazing. It's a state-owned, Punjab is a state-owned bank, a state-owned corporation. Is it the state or the stockholders who, are left holding the bag here?
Well, I think the final bag holder will be the Indian taxpayers. So that will be who will ultimately be left on the hook if the PNB completely went under. I think the shareholders would take the first hit, but ultimately whatever's left over is going to go to the Indian government because it is a state corporation, as you say.
Very interesting. I was going to ask you about what the importance of that is, but you already talked about the takeaways. James, let's stay overseas, kind of, in the few minutes we have left in this segment. Can you tell me is what the initial reaction has been in the Far East to yesterday's firing of Rex? Well, the other day's firing of Rex Tillerson. And the appointment of Mike Pompeo to be his replacement as U.S. Secretary of State?
Well, I can say that the Asian stock markets have had a bit of a mini sell-off. Not a huge tanking, but at any rate, I think investors are a little bit nervous as to what this portends, and coupled with, obviously, the potential for swallies of a China trade war. Obviously, markets are a little bit spooked by that, but I think more generally, there is a sense that perhaps it could be a good move if at least we get some sort of clarification on U.S. foreign policy, or at least some sort of clarification on who is actually making foreign policy for the United States, because I think the sense has been, certainly for the last year or so, that Rex Tillerson doesn't really speak for the White House, and any agreements that are reached with Tillerson ultimately have to go through Trump anyway, because there's a good chance that he'll undermine it or revoke it. So I think there's been a sort of collective frustration in Asia and probably elsewhere in the world over the ineffectualness of the Tillerson State Department. So
yeah.
Perhaps, at any rate, if Pompeo or whoever gets sworn in as the new Secretary of State does have a little bit more authority to speak for the White House, that might at least bring some clarification as to where the U.S. actually stands on some of the foreign policy issues.
Yeah, boy, the credibility of U.S. Diplomacy core has certainly been in question the last year or so largely for the very reason you stated. I found it somewhat ironic that the former CEO of ExxonMobil was brought in probably more so, I was going to say as much as, but maybe even more so, to dismantle the State Department, at least to some extent. I mean, well over 100 positions left unfilled during his first year. It will be interesting indeed to see how the relationships change under Pompeo if he is confirmed. Why don't we take a short break, and I'll be back with James Corbett after these few messages.
Food prices have increased over 40%. Energy prices have increased over 20%. Wheat and gas prices have increased over 70%. What's going to be next? Do you see these trends reversing or even stabilizing? All fiat currencies have always failed and collapsed their economies on their way down. The Roman Empire, China, France, Argentina, Finland, Mexico, Russia, Zimbabwe all tried fiat currency and all collapsed into chaos. Meanwhile, the dollar has lost over 97% of its gold gold value since 1971, when an ounce of gold was valued at $35. If your assets are in paper, you are in danger. Protect your assets with gold and silver. Visit Discount Gold and Silver Trading at DGScoins.com. That's DGScoins.com, or call 1-800-375-4188. That's 800-375-4188. Protect yourself and your family.
We all know that Berkey Water Purification Systems are the most trusted name in water filtration. As an authorized Berkey dealer for over 6 years and serving thousands of satisfied customers, the Berkey Guy offers amazing specials for Berkey water filtration systems. The Berkey Light Systems include a set of self-sterilizing and recleanable black purification elements that purify water by removing chlorine, pathogenic bacteria, cysts, and parasites to non-detectable levels and remove harmful chemicals such as herbicides and pesticides. Order the Berkey Light System today, complete with two black Berkey elements for only $231, and the Berkey Guy will ship your order free of charge. With the purchase of a Berkey Light, the Berkey Guy is also offering a set of fluoride and arsenic filters for only $39.99. That's over 30% off the retail price. Call the Berkey Guy at 1-877-886-3653. That's 1-877-886-3653. Or order online at GoBerkey.com. That's GoBerkey.com today.
And welcome back to Financial Survival. I'm Dave Allen here with our guest, James Corbett, the founder and editor of The Corbett Report. James, about 35 years ago, Milton Friedman wrote in his book, Inflation Causes and Consequences, inflation is always and everywhere a monetary phenomenon. Now, the king of monetarism. Last Friday, as you probably know, a jobs report from the U.S. Department of Labor showed the U.S. economy added 313,000 jobs in February, over 100,000 more than economists had expected. In addition, average hourly earnings increased by 0.1% month on month and 2.6% year on year. So a blip up in the CPI and soaring job creation. Conventional Fed thinking holds that too much job creation drives up wages, which trickles down to create inflation. And according to some observers, the Fed clings to the idea that inducing unemployment actually cures it. And then there's the perceived need to raise the inflation level to get the economy out of its post-recession stupor that started 10 years ago. Inflation is always and everywhere a sign that the Fed is injecting more liquidity into the money markets than those markets demand, causing, after a fairly predictable lag, rising price levels. The big question for the Fed, plus other policymakers, is will higher real wages, which is generally a good thing, I think we can argue, especially on a personal level anyway, will higher real wages contribute to rising consumer price levels, or won't they? I mean, inflation comes from the Fed hitting the gas pedal too hard. Should the White House be worried that the CPI core inflation rate suddenly jumped up? And should that cause the Fed to tighten? Well, there's a lot of uncertainty for sure, especially with Jerome Powell now taking the helm of the Fed. I guess we also have to keep in mind the wishes of the U.S. president, who has the power to sink the U.S. dollar if he chooses to do so. Many have, and many of them with not so good results. My question to you, James, is with these blips in the U.S. economy, should the Fed speed up its tightening and hike interest rates more frequently than its current plan? And if it does continue to raise rates, how do you see that affecting the U.S. bond and stock markets and ultimately gold and silver?
Well, the Fed should disband, and we should go back to an era of free banking, but that's maybe not in the political cards at the moment. But I think there are a couple of other factors that we have to keep in mind with regards to inflation. Of course, it does ultimately come down to the monetary spigot, but there are other factors at play there. For example, over the last decade or so, the average worker, the average person has dug themselves even deeper in the hole in terms of credit and extending their lines of credit. And so it's not necessarily the case that increases in wages or income would translate directly into spending or purchasing in the economy. It might go down to paying down debts, which would not be productive in the economic sense and would not contribute to inflation. So there are different factors that play into that. And I think we have to keep in mind that, again, the last decade or so of stagnation, the so-called non-recovery recovery that we've experienced mm-hmm. since the Lehman meltdown, we saw the Fed wasn't just injecting that monetary liquidity directly into the economy. They were, of course, giving it to the banks, and in a special way, a way that they didn't normally do, which was purchasing treasuries and also purchasing mm-hmm. The mortgage-backed securities, the other toxic assets that the banks couldn't get off of their books. That ultimately ended up being parked to a large extent at the Fed in the accounts that those banks hold with the Fed. And in fact, the Fed was even paying banks to hold money in those accounts for a long period of time. I'm not sure if those rates still exist, but still, there was a monetary incentive for banks to simply hold on to that money. As a result, we saw monetary velocity drop over that period to, if not all-time lows, certainly I think century-long lows of monetary velocity, i.e. money is not circulating in the economy to anywhere near the extent that it does in a healthy, vibrant economy, which also means that the money that was being created by the Fed over the last decade didn't contribute to very much inflation. Now, as economic activity picks up and things start to improve and people start spending, that will obviously translate into some inflation. It's just a question of, you know, how much and how soon. And this is where central planners and others of other controllers or would-be controllers of their ilk get to try to, you know, scry the tea leaves and try to read, well, okay, so are people paying their way out of debt right now, or are they going into spending mode, and how much is that going to translate into inflation, and how much should we be tightening to counteract that? And that's all of the kind of central planning, I think, nonsense that goes into the economic wizardry that defines our central banking-controlled era. But at the end of the day, I think the real valuation of the dollar is in commodities, real commodities like gold. People often think, oh, what is the price of gold? And they think of the price of gold in dollars. It should be the exact inverse. What is the price of dollar in gold is probably more to the point, because obviously the gold is not changing. The dollar is changing, and the supply of the dollar is changing, and that is essentially measured in gold, along with other things like the extent that people want to hold some sort of physical commodity as a store of value. So I think we're going to see, obviously, an upward push as inflation kicks in on the price of gold and silver and other hard commodities. It's just a question of how much and how soon.
Thanks for those insights. If I could follow up on that, you mentioned central bank nonsense. What are your thoughts about the U.S. Fed policies on inflation at a 2% goal rate and full unemployment at 4.1%. I mean, I guess in terms of monetary policy, they're certainly relevant in a political and I guess an economic sense. But in the broader scheme of things, are they meaningful?
Yeah,
meaningful policies.
Very good question. And in what way, and who does it benefit, and who falls through the cracks is always the question.
Yeah.
And it's a good question because looking at it from the Japanese perspective, of course, Japan has this goal of 2% inflation that it's had for really three decades now since the bubble burst, and the Japanese economy has just been in stagnation mode for all of that time. And every year, every few months even, the Bank of Japan governor is wheeled out to pronounce, oh, I think we're going to hit it. I think we're going to get that 2%, and you know, maybe we get to 0.1%, maybe 0.2% if there's a real tear in the economy here. So it is just that ever-present goal, that thing that's off in the horizon that, of course, everyone understands is never really going to be reached, at least in the Japanese context. In the American context, I would say that all things being equal, if you have a growing, vibrant, healthy economy that's built on real productive economic activity and involves a growing demographic base, a growing population, then you do want a little bit of inflation to increase the size of that economy and account for new people coming in and all of that, and rise, gradual rising of wealth. But the idea that that's going to be determined by a central body that's going to know just the right, you know, right intervention to make it just the right time, it's not just unrealistic. It's completely impossible. And in fact, I had a report on this recently that people might want to check into. Let me think about what the title of that report was. But it was about the it was called "Why Economists Are Always Wrong," and it was talking about the fact that that productive activity in the economy cannot be centrally planned. It's not just that central planners are off or they don't have good data. It's that type of activity that connects all of these different workers in different fields to come together to in ways that they don't even experience to make a product is fundamentally not directable by a central source. And the example that was made famous in Leonard Reed's 1960-ish era essay, iPencil, is the pencil, a very simple, one of the most simple things you can imagine. And he goes through and talks about all of the different people that are involved in all of the different processes that collect all of the different materials that are then brought to the factory that are then through various industrial processes made into the pencil that's sitting there on your desk. Is such a vast and really complicated and sprawling activity that really does span the entire globe, not something that you think about generally when you've got that pencil in your hand. And that's just a pencil. Imagine all of the other things that are created in the economy. And the idea that there's some, you know, wizard sitting in some bank in Wall Street is going to be able to understand and direct all of that activity and know just the right thing to do at just the right time is, as I say, it's not just a pipe dream. I mean, it is a pipe dream. It's not just a goal. It's completely unattainable.
Yeah, you frame it like that, it really becomes absurd in a sense. Well, thanks for that insight. You know, turning to your feature article in the Corbett Report newsletter of 2 weeks ago, you begin with this passage: "Goodbye Asia Pacific, hello Indo Pacific." It's a question mark. You continue, "That's right, the old Asia-Pacific label is so last decade, guys. It's time to start calling that part of the globe the Indo-Pacific." Then you ask, "Who cares if it's geographically nonsensical? America's military planners and their think tank lackeys are starting to change their nomenclature, and you should too." Ironically, at least as of yesterday, you mentioned that the term entered the vernacular last year when the sudden former Secretary of State Rex Tillerson used it in his remarks on defining our relationship with India for the next century. James, what's going on here? Tell listeners how this semantic gamesmanship came about, what's really behind it, how the geopolitical consequences are playing out between India, China, the U.S., and others.
Well, as I say, this does stem from Tillerson's speech last October, where he was talking about America's relationship with India. So perhaps that might change under a new State Department. We'll find out. But at any rate, the goal that he was setting, the direction that he was setting, was for the U.S. to become a little bit more chummy with India, and explicitly, as he said in his speech, basically as a bulwark against China. He said China, while rising alongside India, has done so less responsibly, at times undermining the international rules-based order, even as countries like India operate within a framework that protects other nations' sovereignty. So it's basically kind of a rebuke of China to say, oh, it's not Asia-Pacific anymore, it's Indo-Pacific, and we're going to start putting more of our eggs in the Indian basket. Mm-hmm. And as I say, it's explicitly aimed at China, really, more so than it is at propping up India for in India's sake. And this is already playing out. It's interesting to watch the kind of dance that Beijing and New Delhi are doing right now. There's been some diplomatic maneuvering and some hairy situations over the course of the last year or two between China and India. And I cite some of them in the article, including the Indian government not sending Modi or any other high-ranking official to the first ever Belt and Road Forum for International Cooperation that China held last year, which was basically a forum for world leaders to get together and say how much they love China and its new Silk Road project, this $1 trillion or so of investment that they're going to be making in their trading partners to create the new Silk Road of the 21st century. India boycotted that, or at least didn't show up, because they were angry about China's dealings with Pakistan and the fact that they're developing some infrastructure projects in areas that are disputed by India. So there was that tension. And then there was that interesting standoff in the mountain pass in Bhutan last year, where the, China was looking to extend a road that they already had constructed, but they were looking to extend it a little further. And Bhutan said, oh, no, 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 we didn't say you could do that. And India actually ended up sending in its military to draw a line in the sand and say, you are not constructing this road any further, because India and Bhutan have close relations. So India came in to kind of help out. And you literally had the Chinese and Indian military at standing face to face with each other in a standoff for close to 2 months, I believe, last year.
That's a
before
big,
China.
Wow.
It really is. I mean,
did that fly below the radar over here, or is it just?
I think it didn't get reported very much in the Western press that I saw, but it certainly it happened, and it was a pretty interesting situation. China ultimately blinked first. They said, okay, well, we'll stop the construction. But they did not rule out that they will continue it in the future. So that still remains a question mark. And then the latest thing actually involves the Maldives, which people probably don't know, but is going through a constitutional crisis right now. The current president slash dictator slash whatever he is was ordered by the Supreme Court to release several members of the opposition that he have been jailed for several years. And he said no. So there's a bit of a standoff going on there, and the opposition is calling on India. India, won't you come, you know, help restore order to the country? I mean, the Maldives is right in your backyard. And in any other time, India would be involving itself heavily there. But this time, just as this was taking place, China sent in 11 warships into the East Indian Ocean, basically saying, hey, I don't think you guys should be involving yourselves in what's going on in the Maldives, because this embattled president, dictator, whatever, in the Maldives is friendly with China and is accepting some of their money for this Silk Road project. So there's an interesting standoff happening there, and apparently India has backed down, and they have not involved themselves in what's going on in the Maldives, or at least not militarily so. And if you watch the Indian media about this, it's all going back to, well, it's the China's moving in on our territory, what are we going to do about the Chinese threat? So there's definitely some increasing tensions going on between China and India, and I think it's interesting that all of this is developing just as Uncle Sam is apparently whispering in Prime Minister Modi's ear, you know, the Asia Pacific belongs to you. It's the Indo-Pacific now.
You know, and with that, we're going to let James have the last word and thank him so much for joining us again. Listeners, we thank you for tuning in as well. Don't forget to call Discount Gold and Silver at 1-800-375-4188 for all your precious metal needs. James, thank you so much. We'll see you again in 2 weeks, I believe. We appreciate your views and insights, as always.
Thank
you. I'll return on Monday with Melody Cederstrom for another Financial Survival Show. In the meantime, have a good weekend, everybody.